history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, the stories that are there waiting to be told are definitely worth hearing. And we get to hear them each week as we seek to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we always learn a lot. We're educated, yes, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. February, of course, is Black History Month, and we're going to make that the focus of today's episode. We've had the good fortune of meeting quite a few African-American veterans of World War II over the years, and America got to know one of the more than 900,000 African-Americans who served in World War II pretty well over the last week. If you watched Super Bowl 54 long before the Kansas City Chiefs staged their epic comeback, you saw someone else wearing red preside over the pregame coin toss. It was Colonel Charles McGee, a highly decorated member of the 332nd Fighter Group in World War II. He flew 137 combat missions in P-39s, P-47s, and P-51s, escorting American bombers and maintaining the Tuskegee Airmen's perfect record of never losing a bomber that they escorted. After the military was integrated, McGee flew again in the Korean War and the Vietnam War. And just a few days after the Super Bowl, Colonel McGee was honorarily promoted to Brigadier General before being recognized during the State of the Union. The U.S. Air Force released a video of the 100-year-old summarizing what he, the rest of the Tuskegee Airmen, and all 900,000 African-American servicemen in the war had accomplished. You can watch that video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And you can hear Charles McGee's narration right now.
I'm Charles Edward McGee, Air Force retired, and I was born in Cleveland, Ohio in 1919. Tuskegee Airmen are black pilots, mechanics, and support people who, when our country declared war against Hitler, came forward and dispel the biases and generalizations that because of the color of our skin, we couldn't support our country in a technical area. Our task was to keep the air clear of German fighters that were destroying many of our bombers. You know, we thought we had enough guns on the B-17s and B-24s to protect them. That wasn't so, and that's why the escort work began. We also destroyed a lot of Germany's war-making potential on the ground. The Pittsburgh Courier came out and said, no, this is a double victory activity for black Americans, fighting against Hitler in Europe and also fighting against racism here at home. One thing personally, folks say, well, how'd you face that? I said, well, I grew up learning that, you treat others like you want to be treated. So important. And then realizing that the value lessons that sustained us are just as important for the young people today and what they face for America's future and preserving the freedoms we claim we all so much enjoy. Don't let the circumstances be an excuse for not achieving. We could have very easily, they don't like me, they don't want me, and gone off in the corner with our head bowed. That's not the American way.
100 years old and still inspiring people in America and all over the globe, Brigadier General Charles McGee. And just a few weeks before his memorable moments in Miami and in our nation's capital, another ceremony took place several time zones to the west, when for the first time a U.S. aircraft carrier was named after an African American. Before we hear from a clip from that ceremony at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, let's listen to this explanation from naval historian Dr. Regina Akers about what Dory Miller, a sailor aboard the USS West Virginia, did to deserve that unprecedented honor.
On 7 December 1941, the Japanese had a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. And one of their specific goals was Battleship Roe. Dory Miller was on the USS West Virginia, a battleship. He had just finished serving and he was sorting laundry when the first enemy attack hit his ship, the West Virginia. During that time, everybody on the crew has a battle station. When Dory reports to his, that part of the ship is damaged, so he moves on. He encounters an officer who is with the captain of West Virginia, Captain O'Banion, and he's got a mortar attack, shrapnel attack, rather. He's been hit by shrapnel, and he's injured, seriously injured. And so the officer asks him to move, assist him in moving the captain to a safer deck, which he does. And then he proceeds, when they reach that deck, to respond to the attack. And he and an officer look, there's an ammunition gun there, a 50 caliber anti-aircraft gun, and Miller takes the gun and he shoots. Now what's extraordinary about that is, as a mess attendant, normally his battle station would have been to hand the ammunition up to the gunner, because blacks weren't allowed to be gunners, to fill the gunner's mate rate at that time. But Dory literally took the gun and started shooting. And there's lots of stories. Did he shoot something down? Did he not? We really don't know. No one is credited with a shoot down at Pearl Harbor. He says, had said in several interviews, he thinks he might have hit one or two. And that's why that carries on into our time, that Dory Miller shot down planes at Pearl Harbor. I should add, too, that in addition to that, the ship's severely damaged, can't be saved. One of O'Banion's last thing is to give the abandoned ship order. And so Dory Miller, there are injured people and sailors trying to move about the ship. He assists them, and then once he's in the water, he continues to do that. So his heroism didn't stop with firing a gun, is the point I want to make. It continued throughout the events of that morning, that fateful morning. When Dory Miller entered the Navy in 1939, blacks were limited to specific ratings. And Jim Crowism in society, separation of the races, was also the practice and policy in our military by virtue of our War Department. And so the Navy discriminated against blacks by the types of ratings that they could fill. The idea was that they couldn't do any more than manual labor. The Navy hadn't recruited a black in general service since 1922. So when Miller enters in 39, that's what he's coming into. But he's from Waco, Texas, so racism and discrimination are not far from his experience. It's important to the Navy on a couple of levels. One, Dory Miller is a hero, his heroism, his response, putting the captain to a safer place. Dory Miller's actions, though he didn't wake up that morning and decide to be a hero, contradicted the popular belief that blacks and whites could not serve together effectively and efficiently, that blacks could not perform in combat, that blacks were, some of the stereotypes, that blacks were afraid of water. It contrasted that quite a bit. After this happens, Dory Miller is put in for an award, initially by Secretary of the Navy William Franklin Knox. He decides that Dory Miller should get a letter of commendation. And the president and Chester Nimitz, who succeeded husband Kimmel as a commander-in-chief of the Pacific, disagree. And the president intervenes. Now, keep in mind, Chester Nimitz had just come from what we call today the Bureau of Naval Personnel before he took that job. And so he understood the significance for the Navy, because for the Navy, Dory Miller is going to become a symbol or a means of recruitment to encourage other blacks to enlist. And also keep in mind that just prior to this, earlier in that year, there was a threat for a march on Washington because the war industries were not hiring African Americans. And so A. Philip Randolph, who was the president of the Sleeping Car Porters, proposed a march on Washington to protest this. So Roosevelt has all these things in mind when this happens. Anyway, consequently, they intervene and Dory Miller receives the Navy Cross, which at the time was the third highest award, May 27th of 1942, aboard a ship, Nimitz himself presents it, in Hawaii. And so that's the significance. And also they continue to use him in this way in the sense that he goes on recruitment drives, he goes on war bond drives, his picture's all over the place. So there's that impact for the Navy. If we talk about the African-American community, they didn't learn of Miller's immediate actions or his heroism. And for some, that angered them. When World War II broke out, blacks had second-class status. As I mentioned earlier, this was a segregated country. The branches of the military were segregated by custom, by policy, and by tradition. And so when they learn of Dory Miller, initially he's just described as a Negro sailor. And then later they actually learned his name through a Pittsburgh Courier article. Well, for them, this becomes part of what will become the Double V campaign during World War II that the Pittsburgh Courier initiated. And that was the idea that we can defeat fascism abroad and racism at home during this war. And there was an overall civil rights movement. I spoke earlier of A. Philip Randolph. So he's going to become part of that. This will be a milestone in that because there's a hope. He becomes a symbol of, he's actually in a paradoxical situation because he becomes a celebrity overnight. He has to deal with what that heroism meant and these recruitment drives. The accounts say he was, although he was 6'3 and 220, Dorie Miller was very soft-spoken, you know, not boastful as you would think if you saw pictures of him. So that was a new role for him to play, and it was immediate, right? So for the Navy, he becomes the poster child for this is why African-Americans should join the Navy. But at the same time, he's representing the fact that there are limited opportunities for blacks. For the black community, he becomes a source of race pride, representation of their commitment to the country. And he's also continuing that legacy of African-American service in the military back to the days of George Washington and the American Revolutionary War, and specifically, since we're talking about the Navy, back to the colonial and state navies in that war. So he's continuing that legacy of outstanding service and a willingness to fight for rights which his race was denied here at home. They put coupons in newspapers that advocated, went all over the country, and one advocating that Dorie Miller should be admitted to the Naval Academy. Another advocating that he should be get a commission. Unheard of, right? We hadn't even had black officers at this point in our Navy. They also had rallies. They sent letters and petitions to Congress. Civic, social, and civil rights organizations got involved. As you might imagine, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Some of the sororities, the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. All these and religious organizations came together to advocate for that because he represented a hope that the segregated society didn't have to be that way, and hope for a society where we could have racial equality. And so that lined up with the civil rights movement, continuous civil rights movement in the country's history. Like I said, here's Dorie Miller, you talk about the weight of the world, kinda, finding himself in the midst of all of this, when all he wants to do is get to his next ship, right? That didn't happen immediately because he had these drives. So he becomes a symbol of hope for the black race, and his image is all over the place, in newspapers and magazines, and was using recruitment ads and posters even well after World War II. Heroism is not limited to any one race, gender, or any other demographic, for sure. He was the son of tenant sharecroppers. Very humble beginnings. Where one starts is no indicator of where they can go in life or where they will end up in life. Dorie Miller did not let people's limited expectations of him limit his view of himself or what he could accomplish as a sailor. And that applies to anyone in any profession who's facing any kind of oppression or people trying to hinder your career. He was focused on what he wanted to do. He didn't take his mind off the prize. The other thing was that in the spring of 42, a CB battalion honored Miller by naming their battalion after him. So there was some really immediate impacts. When people were advocating, even in local elections, they would bring up Dorie Miller's heroism. Wendell Willkie, who was President Roosevelt's opponent in the election, he brought it up. So there's that sort of immediate impact. The Navy will eventually honor Miller in many ways. There'll be facilities named after him, like a barracks. There's a park in Hawaii named in honor of Miller and his family. If you go to just about any museum, you will see Miller celebrated and featured in the World War II section. And that includes our new museum, National Museum of African American History and Heritage, the world-famous World War II Museum in New Orleans. I've seen it. And certainly the one at Pearl Harbor. But there are parks, there are schools, and I'm not just talking about Waco, Texas, where he's from. that where he's given, efforts have been given to give him due honor.
And the latest and greatest honor came from Acting Secretary of the Navy Thomas Modley in naming the new aircraft carrier CVN-81 the USS Doris Miller. Not only the first carrier named for an African-American serviceman, but also the first carrier ever named for an enlisted man.
The USS Doris Miller will be our most advanced and lethal warship. More than that, it will be the most advanced and lethal ship the world has ever seen. But beyond her capabilities as a warfighting platform, wherever this ship and her strike group may travel, the USS Doris Miller will also be a reminder of the ongoing journey for justice that has defined our nation, a tribute to our enlisted personnel, and a living, tangible memorial to all those who fought in World War II. Every sailor and Marine who sails on board the USS Doris Miller must honor its namesake's legacy by showing the same initiative, professionalism, and commitment that Messman Miller did under the harshest possible conditions imaginable. And then every one of us here today must honor the dignity and leadership Doris Miller showed as he spoke across the country, igniting a moral fight for justice and catalyzing change that would eventually transform our country and transform it for the better. Wherever and whenever the people of the world will see the USS Doris Miller, they will know what we value, what we stand for, and who we are as a people. And they will remember the extraordinary journey that brought us here, how we have never relented in pursuing justice at home and abroad, and the ongoing work and peace that we must pursue as long as we remain a nation. Doris Miller was the son of a sharecropper, a descendant of slaves. He was not given the same opportunities that men of a different color were given to serve his country. But on December 7th, 1941, he would not be defined by the prejudice of other peoples. He was not just a sailor, he was an American sailor, so designated by the uniform that he wore, the same uniform all American sailors wear and still wear, regardless of race, ethnic background, accent, religion, or political persuasion. He was the greatest of sailors because he was an American sailor. And as an American sailor, in the violence and chaos of that awful December day, it was his character, not his skin color or his uniform, that ordained that he would become something even more than that, that he would become an American hero. And it is for that reason that Doris Miller will sail into history from this point in place forward, adorning the most powerful American warship in the world for the better part of this century. It is an honor that he, his family, and all those who struggle for civil rights within our Navy and our nation duly deserve. May God protect all those who sail on the USS Doris Miller, and may God continue to bless this nation and all of the sailors and Marines who go in harm's way every day to keep us safe and to keep us free.
Again, that was Acting Secretary of the Navy Thomas Modley in excerpts from the ceremony dedicating the newest American aircraft carrier in honor of Pearl Harbor hero Dory Miller, who was later killed in action while serving aboard the USS Liscombe Bay in November 1944. It's time for our first break, but there's more to come on this special edition of Hometown Heroes. Hear from one trailblazer on the diamond and another in the operating room about their World War II experiences. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of Black History Month, focusing on the contributions of more than 900,000 African-American men and women who served in our then segregated armed forces during World War II. Among them were many who would make their names as amazing athletes. The legendary boxer Joe Louis volunteered for the Army just a month after the attack on Pearl Harbor. If you ever visit Arlington National Cemetery, his grave is prominently featured there. Archie Williams had won gold in the 400 meters in the Berlin Olympics in 1936. He became a Tuskegee Airman. Jackie Robinson, who would go on to break baseball's color barrier, had a well-documented stint in the Army during World War II. Larry Doby, the first black player in the American League, served in the Navy in World War II, following in the footsteps of his father, who had served in World War I. But what you don't hear about too often is the fact that one of Doby's Negro League teammates, Monty Irvin, was actually offered the distinction of becoming the first African American in the majors. And the reason that's not the way it happened relates back to his Army service in World War II. Born in Alabama as one of 13 children in a family with legendary athletic talent, Monty Irvin grew up in New Jersey, and I love this wrinkle, while playing college football, he moonlighted as a professional baseball player in the Negro Leagues, playing only road games, no home games, under the pseudonym Jimmy Nelson so his double life wouldn't be discovered. Can you imagine one of college football's top talents trying to pull that off today? Irvin's experiences in barnstorming tours with major league stars made it clear that the players in his league could hold their own, but baseball's color barrier remained.
Well, we were disappointed, and We made some friends with some of the major leaguers, and we told them, we said, why don't you guys talk it up? You know, maybe we could help him win a pennant or a World Series. So they said, well, we'll do what we can, but you know how negative the owners are. I said, well, keep talking, because it's bound to happen one of these days. And sure enough, in 1946, Bob Feller, one of my dear friends, he formed an all-star team, and Satchel Paige formed an all-star team, and they played each other. They broke about even, but it showed everybody, you know, including the scouts, that we could play baseball as well as anybody. All we needed was a chance. And after that, the scouts out there looking for talent signed a lot of the African-American players.
Now, you at one point left the Negro Leagues and went to the Mexican League, won a triple crown there. But I understand, with all the great hitters that you could have looked at to model your game after, it wasn't someone in your league, but it was an Italiano wearing pinstripes that you modeled your swing after. Is that true?
That's true. Joe DiMaggio. I saw him when he broke in with the Yankees in 1936. I was hitting the ball well, but I wasn't hitting the ball a lot to right field. So I want to, you know, being a right-handed hitter, I wanted to pull the ball, so I used to go there and watch him, and he was a dead pull hitter, and how quick he was, you know, when he was getting the bat around with his follow through, and how graceful he looked at the plate and so on. So in 39, when I went to Daytona Beach for spring training, I practiced hitting the way he did, and by the time spring training was over, I had it. And from 39 on, I became a pretty good hitter, I tell you.
Well, yeah, 422 is pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was tough to strike out. I was strong, you know, naturally strong. And all I needed to do was just get that bat around a little quicker. And with the Joe DiMaggio stance and the fact that, you know, you didn't stride very far, maybe 4 or 5 inches, you could judge the ball and see the ball and be in position to hit a curveball, changeup, or fastball. So it didn't take me long to copy Joe. Later on, I told him about it. He said, "Well, I'm glad somebody thought enough of me to copy my style."
Mm-hmm. Well, it worked pretty well for you.
And guess
too.
What? Willie Mays did the same thing.
Hey, there you go. Everyone seems to have a memory.
Yep.
Of December 7th, 1941. Yep. Do you remember how you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Standing on second base in Puerto Rico.
Really?
When they announced that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, and the people started to cheer. So I said to myself, they don't know, you know, what a big problem that's going to be, because everything that came into Puerto Rico came in on a ship.
Mm.
You know, the rice and the beans and everything else. And then 3 weeks, everything, rice and beans tripled. The price of rice and beans tripled down there. And so I definitely will remember, you know, being on second base when I heard that this disastrous thing has occurred.
Yeah, not many people can claim that they were standing on second base at the time.
Yeah.
And then Uncle Sam would get his hands on you. What did it mean to you when you were drafted and you realized that you're going to have to put baseball on hold and go
yeah,
serve?
I did. I had just left Mexico, you know, of MVP down there. But I knew that, you know, you had to go. I had a daughter who was only 6 months old. I didn't want to leave her and my wife. But, you know, Uncle Sam called, saying we had to go. I was drafted, spent my training in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and after about 6 weeks, went on down to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And then in a few months, we caught the a troop ship going to England. It was in the North Atlantic for 19 days, and the North Atlantic can be rough, even in the summertime, but in the wintertime, it's almost impossible. And so in 19 days, we were on that ship in a convoy of 500 ships. And guess what? We didn't lose one ship out of a convoy of 500. But when we got to Liverpool, we couldn't stand up because of that rocking and roll. Yeah, that was a funny thing.
That would do it to you. And much like baseball was segregated at the time, the military was segregated at this time. And
yeah,
so you
that
were
was
in
tragic.
A, the 1313th Engineer General Service Regiment?
Yes, uh-huh.
With all African-American soldiers?
Yeah, uh-huh. At the beginning, we had a white officer, and later on, he was replaced by an African-American CO, and then we got two or three other lieutenants. You know, we felt, you know, more comfortable, and it was treated a little better. So during... In 1944, after they invaded, June 6, 1944, was D-Day. But we didn't get there until 2 months later. And when we got there, Omaha Beach had been cleaned up. After staying around the beach for a while, we moved across Paris and settled on the other side. And then mainly our duty then became guard duty. A lot of the Nazi soldiers... had surrendered, and there was a problem because there were so many of them. We had it was a chore trying to keep track of all of them. So that's what we mainly did until the war was over in Japan.
Now, I did read that your unit, during the Battle of the Bulge, that your unit was assigned not necessarily on the front line, but in reserve and near Reims, France.
That's true.
In the Meuse line and ready to blow up bridges if the order came.
Yeah, we blow up bridges and doing a lot of guard duty of refineries, because we knew that the Nazis needed fuel. Our whole outfit was guarding the fuel depots, and luckily they stopped them, up at the Battle of the Bulge, and they never did get to Reims. But Reims was only about 60, 70 miles away, and if they had broken through, there was going to be some heavy fighting in and around Reims, France. We're so happy that it didn't happen.
Now, I've read before, and I've interviewed several African-American veterans from World War II who told me about how they were treated overseas and then how they were treated back in the States. Did you notice a difference, and did that time overseas give you a new perspective?
Yes, it did. We were treated better by the natives, by the English and the French and then people from Belgium. We had a lot of problems with our own soldiers. Mainly, and why they wanted to, be so anti, we just couldn't understand it. And then after we came back here, back to the States, we were scorned also, and we couldn't understand why. We were called on to do a job, and we did it. But seemingly, nobody appreciated enough. To welcome us back home.
Well, I'm sure. And on cold nights in France, in a foxhole, you probably weren't thinking I'm going to be a baseball Hall of Famer someday.
No, not at all. In fact, before it went over, I never thought that we'd ever get the chance to, play in the majors.
Mm-hmm.
But after going, seeing how things were done over there and so on. Some of the guys was very happy that they experienced a lot of freedom. And when we came back, the saying was, if they can fight for the country, why can't we play for them? So there was a move afoot, you know, to get us into Major League. I remember Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia had a group, and he was, along with Adam Clayton Powell and some other politicians, had that in their minds to do it. But then Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson, so that
Hold on there, because the way I heard it, Branch Rickey wanted to sign you.
He did, and I signed with him. I told him I'd had a hard time, didn't have a chance to play at all over there, and I said, I'll sign with you, but I'll let you know when I'm ready. He said, well, that's great.
And you had some ringing in your ears from all the artillery overseas?
Yeah, I had an inner ear problem. And 2 years, you know, got better. And then I, you know, started to play like I had been playing. And selecting Jackie, they picked a college-educated person who had gained publicity and notoriety out there at the UCLA. He starred in four sports. He was wasn't the best player, but he was the most adequate person that Branch Rickey could have taken. And then, lo and behold, Jackie improved every year. He became a clutch hitter. He became a real good second baseman. He became very thrilling on the bases. So it shows you that, how I guess smart that Branch Rickey was by picking Jackie, and we're all grateful and very happy that he did such a great job of pioneering.
Oh, and it sounds like one of the reasons you said wait on me is you felt if you were the first one and you weren't 100% that you wouldn't have represented your whole league and whole race
True.
Of people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it worked out just the way it should have.
Worked out just fine. Jackie did a great job. You know, he passed away in 1972. Can't believe that he's been gone that long. But he did one super job. Had to take a lot, but he did. And we're, again, very grateful for the wonderful job that he did.
And I'm grateful for the example Monty Irvin set for 96 years before his passing in 2016. You can link to his entire original interview on this program at hometownheroesradio.com. And we're not done yet with this special episode in honor of Black History Month. When we come back, a man who is still teaching classes more than 75 years after he served in World War II and more than six decades after he pioneered open heart surgery in the area where he still makes his home. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of Black History Month as we explore a few examples from the more than 900,000 African Americans who served in the U.S.'s then segregated armed forces in World War II. In a few weeks, Dr. Fitzalbert Marius will celebrate his 98th birthday in Fresno, California, where he helped perform the city's first open heart surgery in 1958 and continued to work as a cardiac surgeon for more than 50 years. Last year, he became the first person ever recognized with an honorary doctorate from Fresno Pacific University. He continues to teach classes to would-be missionaries and is very active in his church. He's an accomplished author, painter, sculptor, and tailor, among other things. And he signed up for the Army Specialized Training Program in World War II because it represented a shorter path to a career in medicine. He had no idea what kind of confusing and eventually dangerous path that would become.
That was in December 1942. I joined, enlisted in the Army under that thing. And at the end of my second year, they took me out of there and came down at Oxford, Pennsylvania, and picked us, all of us who had joined that program, and took us up to Fort Dix, New Jersey, where we would be interviewed. So I wound up at Fort Dix, and now this is very, very interesting, and if it hadn't happened to me, because as you know, back in that time, the Army was absolutely segregated. No blacks could be in a white part of the Army. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, very few black officers. The officers over most of the black units were white officers who did not meet the qualifications to be over the white units. And they became the lieutenant and the captain over your units, like they were over mine. And they had certain kinds of things, myths and so on, during that period of time. Like, during that period of time, you only had four races. It's not like today, you know, with the multiplicity of stuff that they have. The four races, white, colored, yellow, and red. And you had to fall in one of those four categories. And there were no other categories you fell into. And blacks, of course, fell under colored. So I wound up there. I remember going in for my interview. And they also had, there was a myth among the whites at that time that you did not look a black male directly in the eye all for any long periods of time, because if you do, it was just like walking on the ladder or black cat crossing or being on the 13th floor.
Oh boy.
So they didn't look at you. Uh-huh. So when I went in, this white lieutenant was sitting on the other side, and I went in and stood up at attention, you know, and he said, not looking up at all, he's looking down at the paper, and it didn't look up at me the whole interview, and says, relax, soldier, sit down. So I sat down, and I'm looking, but he never looked at me, and he began asking the usual questions, says, name, Fitzalbert Michael Marius. Now, that ain't a name like Jim Brown, and on top of that, I had a New York accent with some inflections of the West Indian accent in it. Sure. At that time. So I didn't say y'all, yes, boss, you know, none of that stuff. So I didn't have nothing Southern, nothing sounded like a colored man. And a name, Fitzalbert M. Marius? All right. Place of birth, Colon, Panama, not Biloxi, Mississippi. He went on down the line as education. 2 years of college. Now, most blacks at that time was lucky to make it to the fifth grade. And he just went on and on and on and on. And then he got way down to the, what you call it, do you speak any other language besides English? And I said, yes, sir, I speak French. Because I grew up speaking French. Now, none of these characteristics match anything colored. These characteristics are written down there are the characteristics you find associated with an intelligent white man. So after a while, he looked at the paper, and then he looked up for the first time, and you could see this, his eyes open wide, because what he saw did not match what was on the paper. So he said to me, he says, soldier, private, are you colored? And at that time, I was not very... You know, I didn't have the insight that I have now. If I'd have simply said yes, I'd have gotten into the program. But instead of that, I said, what do you think? And he looked at me and looked at the paper several times. And then he took out something, and he wrote something on the paper, and it says, "Soldier, you're discharged. You may leave." And I left. And the next morning, I was the only person of the group that received an order to get on a train to head for Denver, Colorado, at Fitzsimmons General Hospital. So naturally, I'm a soldier, I obeyed it. And I got all the way to Denver, Colorado, got to Fitzsimmons General Hospital, and it was a base about 1,600 to about 2,000 men. And I was the only individual on that base this color. Everybody else on that base was white. It was a 2.5 to 3 month program where they trained you to work with doctors on the field, you know, as a doctor's assistant, a nurse, you know, and so on down the line. So they put me in a barrack, and I was on the upper bunk, the top of the bed, and at the bottom bed was a young white guy from Georgia, and his father was the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
Now you got to be kidding me. I mean, all of this is hard to believe, but that one, I mean, what are the odds of that?
Yeah, well, the odds of this is, and like I said, if I hadn't experienced it myself, it would be hard to believe, with the Army segregated. So the whole time that I was there, the 2.5 to almost 3 months, I slept with the one eye open because they verbally abused me every opportunity you get. I can't tell you the things they called me. And whenever they got an opportunity, they physically kicked my butt. But just about a week or so before the time was concluded, six of them caught me off to the side by myself, beat my butt up really bad, and then grabbed me by the feet and had me hanging upside down, dipping my head into a barrel of oil where they were going to drown me. And fortunately, a captain came by. And naturally, you know, captain has to follow his orders and not allow any soldier to harm another soldier regardless, you know. So brought no charges against them at all. But anyway, after I left there, I went to Camp Barkley, Texas, which is outside of Dallas. And it was the first time, you know, I didn't know, you know, how did I wind up here in this situation? And naturally, the captain was a white captain, and he was also from Georgia, you know, and he was, then I'm standing at attention, and he's looking at the record, and he just fell out laughing. And naturally, I never changed the expression on my face because you learn as a soldier, you know, how to act, you know. And I just stood there watching. And then finally, after he laughed a while, he reached and got a big, long stamp, which was about 8 inches. And then he stamped right across the middle of the document, colored. And I said, oh, my God. This stupid lieutenant had put down there that I was white. And that's how I wound up in Denver, Colorado, because what he probably said to himself was this. Now, this guy was born in Colon, Panama. Now, he's of dark skin, but he speaks a different language and no color. None of these characteristics meets colored. If I'm going to make a mistake, I would much rather make the mistake the other way around than putting a white man with blacks. So when the Army was completely segregated, Fitz Albert M. Marius, for almost 3 months, was white. but it almost got me killed. It was the worst 3 months that I've ever spent in my whole life.
And I've got to ask you, I mean, you tell the story so well in such captivating fashion, and I don't think you left anything out, but I'm just imagining you, as you described, six guys have grabbed you, so obviously fighting back is futile. They've got you outnumbered. They've overpowered you.
Yeah.
And they're hanging you by your ankles, dipping your face into a barrel of oil. So what's going through your mind as that is happening?
I'm getting killed. That's what's going through my mind.
Yeah.
That's all that's happening. I'm not thinking of nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking I ain't going to make it.
How close do you think you came to being killed right there? I mean, how much longer would it have taken if that guy, the captain, didn't come by?
I don't know. You know, I have no idea of knowing. All I can remember is they were killing my butt, and fortunately the captain came by and my life was saved. Now, little details about how many minutes it was, none of that made any effect on me. Mm-hmm. The major aspect was my life was saved. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can remember. Yeah.
And every veteran I've talked to, it seems like, has at least one moment where his life was spared. Most of those, though, are in the war, not here in the States before you ever got to war, because of this extreme case of mistaken identity that I guess really underscores, not to get up on a soapbox and not to be master of the obvious, but doesn't that underscore the fallacy and erroneous idea that these racist thoughts originate from? I mean, doesn't it expose how stupid racism is?
Of course it does. Of course it does. But it does not change the sociological and social system. Your social system changes from the heart, not from the intellect. You see, you can make all the laws you want. It will not change the way a person feels. They'll work around the laws. I mean, I found I did the same kind of stuff myself, working around the law. Now, before I gave myself over to Christ in 1967, I lived a life of what I would have called integrity, because I was always an honest man. I didn't lie. I told the truth. If I made a commitment, I kept it. Now, the commitment may not have been the right thing to do, but I kept it anyway because I was a man of my oath. Uh-huh. My mother told me, Bertie, don't you ever make an oath you don't keep. You hear that, boy? Mm-hmm. And I can still hear her now. Telling me that. So I kept those kind of oaths. I didn't go out. I was raised Catholic. So marriage meant one woman, one time and stuff. So I wasn't out running after a whole bunch of other women or none of that kind of stuff. But I was just following orders. It was no change of heart involved. And that only occurred after I accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior in 1967, in March the 3rd. And I remember that date very specifically because it was 2 days after my birthday, March the 1st. Mm-hmm. But that's where the difference came, remembering and having a change of heart. You see, not an intellectual attitude, but a change of heart. So anyway, when I wound up in the South Pacific and in all those areas you read about, Guadalcanal and Bougainville and all those places, I was there.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk about how you ended up there. So they, you know, so we don't lose a segment mm-hmm. of the story here. You're in Denver. You almost are killed. They figure out this paper's wrong. He's mm-hmm. clearly not Caucasian. Mm-hmm. They put that big colored stamp on your file.
That's when I went to Camp Barkley, Texas, and went through basic training.
With other African-American troops?
Of course. It was. I was black again. I was one among the white folks no longer.
Uh-huh. How was that different, being with an all-black unit and going through basic training with all black soldiers all of a sudden after the time you'd spent surrounded by nothing but white soldiers?
Well, the number one thing, I was not concerned. I could sleep with both eyes closed. And nobody was going to cuss me out because I was black. They had other reasons too, which they did later on, but not because I was black.
You're an all-black unit. Mm-hmm. That is in the Pacific, and you're following along with the 1st Marine Division. You're attached to the 1st Marine Division. But what was your job? What were you guys supposed to come in and do?
All we're supposed to do was to take care of all of these things like disease, insects, and stuff like that. If there were some certain flies and stuff, we were to get rid of them. We had the stuff to spray, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Dig the ditches, to drain the swamps, you know, and all that sort of stuff. That's what we did. And then of course, when things happened, to bury the dead. Now, what happened, as a matter of fact, it was in Iwo Jima. When we were going in the invasion of Iwo Jima, they had the two units. So one had to go in because there were certain insects and flies and stuff, and that carried a certain amount of certain diseases and stuff that they had to go in to take care of. So they flipped a coin to decide which unit would go in. No, it was a straw. a straw, the short straw and the long straw. All right. So we'd pick the right straw. So they had to go in first with the 1st Marine Division. And there in Iwo Jima, they had caves up there, and the Japanese had the guns and all that stuff on tracks. They pulled them back into the cave. So even though they bombed all the areas and stuff like that before they sent the troops in, they had all the major troops and stuff all back there because there was an airport there that the United States wanted to control and take over. But anyway, when they first sent the 1st Marines in, they also sent the 727th because the 727th lost and they went in. Now, there's 125 people belonging to each one of those groups. Only 3 of them made it back. All the rest of them got killed. Now, if we had gone in first, we would have only had 3 left. Yeah. So the Lord was looking out after me and that group. So, and a lot of things happened like that. And at Guadalcanal, almost got wiped out at Guadalcanal because there, the Japanese at that time, you know, had their planes, and we didn't have the fast planes to keep up with them at that time. And they hadn't just put them out yet. And so they would come in and they would bomb the heck out of the areas. And we were in foxholes and they bombed us for 2 weeks and stuff like that. And all kinds of people got killed and so on. But I made it through. And as a matter of fact, the Lord blessed the heck out of me because the whole 3 years or so that I was over in that South Pacific, I did not get one disease. As many anopheles mosquitoes as I got bitten with, I never got malaria. I never got any of those other diseases and all those other people got shot all around me, and I never got one injury. The Lord was looking out for Bert Marius because I wasn't looking out for myself.
And it's a good thing because over 11,000 open heart operations would have been missing the steady hand of that skilled surgeon. We're out of time on this special edition of Hometown Heroes, but there are quite a few links related to today's content for you to explore at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour.
with honor.